So in the previous lecture, we looked at wave functions and we saw how the quantum state of a single particle can be represented as a wave function. And we saw how these wave functions evolve according to Schrödinger's equation. And then we saw how to solve the Schrödinger equation for a couple of simple systems. And we used this separation of variables technique. In this lecture, we're going to introduce a new type of formalism called Dirac notation. And we'll also lay down some of the formalism of quantum mechanics. And at the end, we'll look at a few techniques that can be used to solve more complicated problems. And these techniques are perturbation theory as well as the interaction picture. Okay, so in the first lecture, we encountered two constructs, the wave function and the operator. And we saw that the system was represented by the wave function, the state of the system was represented by the wave function. And we also saw a number of observables, the Hamiltonian, the momentum, the position. But now instead of dealing with wave functions, we're going to represent states as these abstract, in terms of abstract vector spaces. So there are two reasons for doing this. One of them is that a lot of quantum systems are finite dimensional, for example, spin. And so wave functions are exclusively used to represent continuous dimensional systems. But we need this state vector formalism to deal with discrete ones. And the other one is that not every quantum observable has a classical counterpart. So we can't just make this simple substitution where we take the classical expression and then turn the position and momentum into operators. So that's another example of this is spin. So we need to use other methods to develop our representation of the operators. Okay, so to start, we're going to need a structure known as the Hilbert space. So let's start with that. Now, the Hilbert space is a vector space, but it has two additional properties. So one of them is that it has an inner product. Which is a map. That takes two vectors. And gives a scalar. And the second property is that it's complete in the norm. So there's a formal way to define this in terms of Cauchy sequences, and I think I just saw you guys learned something to do with the Cauchy series. Did Tibor just talk about that or not? Cauchy, okay, so maybe a different thing. I was just erasing it and saw Cauchy on there. So we'll take that formal definition in Joe Emerson's course, but here the only thing that the way that you should think about it is that it's kind of, it doesn't have any holes in it. So the way that a set of real numbers doesn't have any holes in it, but a set of rational numbers does. But we'll get into the formal definition of that in the course in September. Okay, so in this language of abstract vector spaces, the quantum state is going to be represented by a state vector. and I will call it alpha. And so the state vector is postulated to contain all of the information that there is to know about a quantum state. And so state vectors, they can be continuous and they can be discrete. And we can define an inner product between the two state vectors. So there are a number of different ways that you can represent an inner product. One of them So we have an inner product between the alpha state and the beta state. So we can write it like that, or sometimes you'll see it written like this, and sometimes you'll see this sort of notation. And so what Dirac did is that he took this an expression like this, and he suggested that we can break it up. So rather than thinking about it in terms of an inner product between two vectors, we can take this part and call it a ket, and we can take this part and call it a bra. And then we can just treat these two things as separate entities. So we already introduce the ket, the vector state, but what exactly is this bra? It's kind of, you know, a different type of object. And so what it is, it's a linear function that acts on a ket to give you a complex number. So let's write this down. So we take this ket, we use it as acted as a linear function on the bra. Sorry, we take the bra, acted as a linear function on the ket, and we get this complex number that's called the inner product. And so you can talk about the kets living in their own dual Hilbert space, but we won't really go into that either here. We'll go into that in more detail in the September course. But you can, for you know, all practical purposes, you can just think about the kets as just being, you know, a mirror image. Sorry, the bras as just being this mirror image of the ket. They have this dual relationship. So you can think of an alpha ket being related to an alpha bra. So this is known, it's a dual relationship known as the dual correspondence. If we have a linear superposition of two different kets, then the dual to that is another linear superposition, but now these numbers, which are complex numbers, A and B take on a complex conjugate. And this inner product satisfies a few properties. So one of them is that the complex conjugate is just, hang on a second. I'll write it down and then I can say it in words. If we want to take the complex conjugate, we can just swap the two elements inside the inner product. It's also linear. So if we have a beta kit acting on a linear superposition, we can expand it into a linear superposition of inner products. And also, the inner product of an element with itself is going to be positive definite. Which means that it's greater or equal to zero. And so this expression only takes on the equality when the alpha ket itself is equal to zero. Okay, so these are our states and the inner products. And now we're going to talk a little bit about the operators. So we already saw some observables in the previous lecture. So all observables are operators, but not all operators are observables. And we'll discuss in a second about what it is that makes an observable. Okay, so operators, let's say we have an operator X. It acts on a ket from the left to produce another ket. And similarly, it acts on a bra from the right to give you another bra. If we have the case that an operator acting on a ket is equal to a different operator acting on the same ket, then we know that these two operators must be the same. We have something called a null operator. So if the operator acting on the ket gives you zero, then X is the null operator. And we also know that the outer product of a bra and a ket also gives you an operator. The operators, they satisfy a few different properties. So let's say operator addition. So it's commutative, which means that x plus y is equal to y plus x. And it's associative. And it's also linear. Okay, and we can also define some similar properties for multiplication. But in this case, operator multiplication is not going to be commutative. At least in general, but it is associative. And that's also the case if the operators are acting on kets. We can also define a Hermitian adjoint. And so, if we have a operator acting on alpha, that gives the state alpha prime, then the Hermitian adjoint of all of that is given by the Bra version. Okay, and if an operator is equal to its Hermitian adjoint, then we say that X is Hermitian. Right, so all of the observables that you're going to encounter are going to be Hermitian operators. Okay, and two more things. Oh, three more things. Maybe I'll just try and squeeze them in here. We can introduce a commutator of two operators. And we say that if two operators commute, which means that if their commutator is zero, then this is called a set of compatible operators. And if they don't commute, then they are incompatible. Okay, so in the previous lecture, we saw that we're often dealing with solving eigenvalue equations, like the time-independent Hamiltonian equation, time-independent Schrodinger equation. And so we can also do this in this formalism. So if an operator acting on a state gives a complex number, and the state then we say that phi is an eigenstate of the operator A. And similarly, there's a dual relationship for the bras. Okay, and if A was a Hermitian operator, then this would also be, you wouldn't have a complex conjugate there because the eigenvalues of Hermitian operators are real. Okay, so if we have an appropriately normalized operator, a Hermitian operator, we can diagonalize it and then use those diagonal states as a orthonormal basis to represent any of our states or any of our operators. So how do I want to write this? Okay. For normalized operator, the eigenstates form a complete orthonormal set. So we can write any state as a linear combination of the eigenstates of this of the operator. So we can decompose, let's say, this state alpha as a linear combination. Of the eigenstates of A with these coefficients CA. And the coefficients themselves are just going to be given by the projection or the inner product of this eigenstate onto the state that you're trying to decompose. Yes? Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if this will help. Suitably normalized, where I'm not defining what that means. I can't answer that off the top of my head at the moment, but can you ask me again in the tutorial and we'll try and get back to it? Because the only way that I can think about defining it at the moment is in a circular way, where if I say that it forms an orthonormal set. Yeah, it might be that the eigenvalues all sum to one, but that wouldn't tell me anything about the eigenstates. Yeah, let's get back to it. Yeah, I'm saying words, but I'm not writing them down. So. Yeah, let me rewrite this. Yeah, it's supposed to be Hermitian. Is that okay? So the Hermitian operator is going to be self-adjoint. Okay. Okay, so if we now plug this back into the coefficients here, we can write that alpha is given as a sum over A and since alpha can be any state, we can identify this as the identity operator. And we can do the same thing for the continuous case. So let's say we have some sort of continuous parameter x. Like the position, then we can write down the completeness relation in terms of an integral over these eigenstates x. And so if we do this, we can now make a natural connection between the wave functions that we were dealing with in the previous lecture and the Dirac notation in this lecture. So let's just take an arbitrary state psi. And multiply it by the identity, but we'll do it in the position basis. And then we can identify this thing as the wave function in the position basis. So we can say so this wave function is a set of a continuous set of coefficients that tell me how my state is composed as a linear superposition of these position basis states. And I mean, you can do this in any basis. You can do it in the momentum basis as well. So we'll just put in the identity, but in the momentum basis. And then we can say that this is equal to, we'll just call it psi twiddle. But now this thing is going to be the wave function in the momentum basis. Okay, so far we've been dealing with these things in an abstract sense, but we can also represent all of these vectors, well, state vectors in matrix representation. And sometimes it's easier to kind of get a grasp of what's going on when you're manipulating these things if you think back to the matrix representation, which you may be more familiar with. Okay, so if I have an operator X, I can represent that as a matrix X, where this symbol I'm just using to mean is represented by. And so a matrix X is going to have elements Xij, which are going to be given by the projections of the operator in some basis. So you can choose any basis that you like, and depending which basis you choose, you're going to have a different matrix that represents the quantum state. So the quantum state itself contains all the information, but the matrix is going to only give you, at least, just by glancing at it, you'll be able to get information about the state in a particular basis. Okay, and we're going to say that X is a n by n matrix, where n is the dimension of the Hilbert space for that operator. We can also do this for the state vectors. So a state vector is going to be represented by a column matrix. Where each of the elements now is a projection onto the vector. And similarly, you're going to have to pick a particular basis in which you want to write your vector. And then we can do the same thing for the bra. Except now the bra, rather than being a column vector, it's going to be a row vector. Okay, and all of in the matrix representation, we can define all of the counterparts that we have in the Dirac notation. So things like the Hermitian adjoint is going to be the complex conjugate transpose. Matrix multipli operator multiplication is going to be matrix multiplication. But when you when you multiply all of these things together, make sure that, or when you act operators on states and so on. Make sure that you're in the same basis. I wonder if we're still online. Can you hear me, AV? Okay, anyway.
Hey, I think we're still recording, so you're
Okay.
good to go ahead.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
do you know what happened? It doesn't
Still
matter.
power outage.
Okay. Thanks. Okay, great. So in the tutorial, we'll talk a little bit more about the relationships between the matrix representation and the operator representation. Okay, so now we've now set up how we can represent operators and states and bras, which act on the states to give inner products. Now we'll talk a little bit about measurement. And so, okay. So in quantum mechanics, it's different to classical mechanics. Like classically, you're going to have a particle which has a state, and you can just like find out what the state of that particle is. But quantum mechanically, you can't. You actually don't have access to the wave function, which is strange. But you can do things. You can make measurements that ask certain questions about the properties of the wave function. So let's set up the situation. Okay, let's say I have a particular state, alpha, and I'm going to now, actually, okay. Let's say I'm going to describe my measurement by a observable called A. So it's going to be a Hermitian operator, and it's going to have eigenvalues, eigenstates. Let's say AI. And so if I have a state alpha, and I make a measurement on it where my measurement represents this measurement operator A, then I'm going to kind of throw the state into a projection of one of these, the eigenstates of the operator. So let's just decompose it. Maybe I want to say this, write this down differently. Measurements described by the by an observable A with eigenstates A I. So if I start off with the state alpha and I perform a measurement, then I'm going to be thrown into one of the eigenstates A. And so in general, the state of the system is going to be changed, unless we have the special case where the state actually starts off in one of the eigenstates. Then when we make the measurement, we're just going to not change the state. And in general, when we make this measurement, so we, in a lab, when you're trying to set up some sort of measurement, you have control over what measurement you're making. So you can control what observable you're measuring. But you can't control which outcome you're going to get. So even if you prepare the same state over and over again, you're going to get a different outcome, and it'll be random. There's nothing in the formalism of quantum mechanics that can tell you that given a particular state of a system that it'll tell you that you'll get a particular measurement outcome. So the only thing we can really say is we can describe the probabilities with which we're going to get each of the outcomes. So we can say, the probability of getting outcome A is going to be given by the overlap of the eigenstate A and the state alpha, and that's going to be mod squared. And so to determine these probabilities, we have to prepare the state over and over and over and over again, and it's exactly the same state. And then we make the same measurement over and over again, and eventually we'll get some sort of histogram that will, in the limit of infinite number of measurements, will correspond to this probability distribution. And I just wanted to make a comment about language. When you say, I'm going to make a measurement, the thing that you're referring to is this operator A. So you measure the observable A. You don't measure the outcome. Actually, I'll talk about projectors in a second, because the projectors are the things that tell you what the measurement outcome was. But you don't ever measure the projectors. The projectors are something that kind of just happens. But like the thing you have control over, the thing that you're measuring is the observable. So I'll finish the section on measurement and come back to that again. Maybe it'll be a little bit clearer. Okay, so we have the probability of getting the outcome A. We don't have control over what outcome A we're going to get, but given an outcome A, we can at least make a statement about the state after the outcome. So after getting that outcome. So given measurement outcome A, then the state of the system I'm going to call it psi A, and it's going to be given by this projector acting on A, projector that depends on A acting on your initial state, and then you have to normalize it by this probability. And so this projector is just given by an outer product of the eigenstate. And so later when, probably like in the fourth lecture, and then in Joe's course, we abandon this notion of observables, and we don't describe measurements in terms of observables. Generally, you describe measurements in terms of these projection operators. And then we'll extend that to more general types of operators called POVMs, so projector. Oh my God, no, I don't remember what it stands for. But they're generalized measurements that can let you do many more interesting things and explain many more interesting experiments than you can just with this formalism of observables. Okay, and so, right, so I often hear students say things like, I measured like pi A. So I measured the projector pi A, but like, it's not really the correct way to use the language. You should say I made a measurement that corresponded to a set of projectors pi A, and that set of projectors are the projectors made up out of the eigenstates corresponding to this observable. But we'll come back to it. I mean, this will come up, I guess, during the tutorials when we start discussing measurements. Okay, and the last thing that I wanted to say on measurement is that we can, in terms of these in terms of this way of formulating things, we can also write down the, an expectation value. So we can say an expectation value is given by oh my gosh, I've totally messed this up here. Okay, if I have a particular state, alpha, and I want to know what the expectation value of the operator A is, then I'm going to just sandwich the operator in between the bra and the ket corresponding to the state. And so this kind of agrees with our intuition of what an expected value is. So let's just confirm that that's the case. So we can rewrite this by plugging in a bunch of identities. So I'm going to have to do this on the fly because my notes are formatted wrong. is going on here? Okay, let me just check that that's correct. Yeah, I think that's correct. Okay, so here what we have is the measured value. And this thing here just corresponds to the probability of obtaining that value. So, you know, when you calculate the mean, you're just going to multiply the outcome by the probability of getting that outcome and then add everything together. Okay, so we've done states, we've done measurement. The last thing to cover is time evolution. So, of course, it's going to be given by Schrödinger's equation. But let's see exactly how that fits into this formalism. So we're going to be interested in a situation where we have a state that at time zero, and then it's going to evolve. And we're going to get some other state at a later time t. Okay, and to study how this is going to happen, we're going to introduce a time evolution operator. So our operator is a function of t. It acts on our initial state at time t0, and it gives us the state at time t0 plus t. And the time evolution operator has the following properties. So it's unitary. If you compose two operators, so you multiply by one unitary operator and another time operator, if it's the same operator, then that just gives you evolution for a time that's the sum of both of those times. So I mean that u of t1, u of t2 is equal to u of t1 plus t2. And of course, in the limit that time goes to zero, we expect the time evolution operator to go to the identity because we don't want anything to be happening then. So how do we get a particular U of t for a given system? Well, we're going to solve Schrodinger's equation, except now Schrodinger's equation is for the actual operator rather than the state. So in general, the Hamiltonian is going to be time dependent, and it's also not going to commute at different times. And so the solution to the Schrodinger equation in this case is going to be given by what's known as the Dyson series. So we'll have unitary evolution operators given by 1 plus this nasty looking series. And it's got a whole heap of these nested integrals. Or you can write it in this kind of more compact notation, which is given by what's known as the time operator acting on the exponential of the Hamiltonian integrated over time. So, I mean, this looks kind of nice, but this time ordering operator that you act on here is kind of an instruction to tell you that you should expand it according to this this series that has all of these nested integrals in it. And so this thing's like a pain to solve. I don't know if you've ever had to solve something like this, but it's really unpleasant. But fortunately, it's not always the case that our Hamiltonian is going to have these most general properties. Sometimes we might have a Hamiltonian that is time dependent, but it commutes at different times. So in that case, we have a simpler solution. Okay, in this case, then we just have a nice exponential. Now, this almost looks the same as what we have up there, but you know that time operator tells us you have to do this ridiculous number of nested integrals. Here, I mean, you can do this integral just once inside the argument and then do the Taylor series expansion, so it really simplifies calculations. Okay, so sometimes life is simpler and it does commute. The Hamiltonian does commute at different times, and sometimes, you know, like we have a time-independent Hamiltonian. That's when life is really great. And if that happens, then we just have this very nice expression. And this is the one that we were dealing with all throughout the lecture yesterday. Okay, so sometimes we have a situation where h is not time dependent, so that's great. But still, it's not obvious how to solve the problem exactly. Sometimes, even though it's time independent, the Hamiltonian can still take on a complicated form. And so in those situations, we try to use useful methods to solve these complicated cases. So often it happens that the situation that we're interested in is very close to a situation that we know the solution for, and it differs just slightly. And so in those cases, what we can do is take this known solution and then treat this deviation from the known solution as a perturbation. And so this is done using perturbation theory. And in this lecture, I'm just going to cover the simplest version of perturbation theory, which is where the Hamiltonian is time independent. And we've just got the degenerate case. Things get a little bit more complicated when the eigenstates are non-degenerate. So let's consider that our total Hamiltonian is given by a Hamiltonian H0 plus a perturbation, which will be given by the operator V and this parameter lambda. So lambda is a parameter that goes between 0 and 1. Typically, we like to, we hope that it's small so that we can expand in it. It's a real parameter, and it's used to keep track of the number of times that the perturbation was actually the order to which we implement the perturbation. So we assume that we know the solution to the unperturbed case. We know that the energy levels and the eigenstates of the perturbed solution are going to look like this. So what we're going to do is now expand the eigenstates for the perturbed case and the eigenvalues for the perturbed case in a power series. And we're going to use lambda as the expansion parameter. So we say that n is equal to a first order term, which corresponds to the known solution. And similarly for the energy. And so each one of these, so E subscript I is going to be the ith correction to the energy, and N subscript I is going to be the ith correction to the eigenstate. And then what we do is take those expansions and substitute them into the equation that has the star. And so we get something that looks like this. If I were you, I would not be writing any of this down, because I will give you the notes. And I mean, so I would just like follow what's going on, but you don't have to write it down. You can write it down later. Okay, so you've got this expression. It looks kind of yuck, but it's just, you know, substituting those guys into that equation. And then what you do is you expand everything out, and you just collect like orders, components which correspond to the same order in lambda. So the zeroth order is just going to correspond to this known solution that we have here. Okay, great. The first order will give So you see that it's something that depends on the zeroth order correction and the first order correction. And the second order depends on the second order correction and also the first order correction and the zeroth order correction. Okay, so this equation is sufficient to find the solution to second order. So what can we do? We let's say, let's call this double star. And I'll call this triple star. So we can take this equation, double star, and multiply it from the left by the ket n0, the bra n0. And we get the correction, the first order correction to the energy. So how can we see this? So if, on this side, at least, if we have an n, n0, actually, oh yeah. If we have an n0 here, then we're going to have this Hamiltonian act, you know, on the left. And so that'll just pull out e to the n0. So that whole term is going to disappear. And if we have an n0 on this side, then this is just a number, so the n0, that actually just gives us a 1. How does that work? Oh, yeah. No, that's fine. Yeah. So the n0 acts from that side, so the inner product of the state with itself gives us 1, so we just get e to the e sub n 1, and then this part will give us, well, this expression here, and then you just bring that over to the other side, and we get a number e n, which is equal to the projection of that operator in the basis of the known solution. Okay, if we want to get the first order correction to the state, we get we'll multiply from left by n0, and so we get something that looks like this. And then from that, we can rewrite it as the first order correction is given by a sum over m not equal to n. Some projections onto the perturbed Hamiltonian using solutions that we already know. And then we have this energy difference here. And so it's going to, the correction is going to be a linear superposition of the other known solutions. So you kind of get this mixing of the different solutions. And so my plan was to show you the second order correction as well, but we've run out of time. So I'm going to defer that to the tutorial. You guys can do that yourself if you're interested in. And so the other thing that I wanted to do was show you the interaction picture. And then I wanted to show you how you can actually use the interaction picture to solve a problem. But I don't think we'll have time to sketch out. Well, OK, I was just going to sketch out how to solve the problem and then get you guys to solve it in the tutorial. But so what I'll just do now is do the interaction picture. And then I'll put a few more details into the tutorial sheet so that you guys will be able to solve it without having me cover it in the lecture. But just, yeah, just to maybe finish off what's going on here. So we've calculated the first order correction to the energy and to the state. And so then you just plug it back into here. And then you can, using the known solutions to the first order correction, you can figure out the second order correction, and then you plug it into here. And so you get the expression for the state that you're actually trying to solve, the perturbed case. And the higher and higher order you go to, the better your approximation is going to be. So far, all the situations we've dealt with have been where the potential has been time independent. But of course, we can have situations where the potential is does depend on time. So it would look something like Hamiltonian is, well, again, break it up into a known Hamiltonian plus a potential that depends on time. And again, we're going to assume that we know the solution to this component. And as we saw, I guess here, you know, in the case where we have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, the solution is not going to be as simple as the case that we dealt with yesterday. We're going to have a more complicated expression for the solution. But one thing we can do is go into the interaction picture, and that makes these problems much easier to solve. So, pardon me? It is not a perturbation. It can. You don't have to consider it to be a small difference to the to differ only slightly from the original solution, from the known solution. It's. We're not going to use perturbation theory. We're going to use a different method. So in this case, we're just considering situations. It's not going to be perturbation theory. So it's, I guess, a more general case. But the interaction picture is going to be useful in some situations, and it might not be useful in other situations. And so you might want to use perturbation theory in those situations. But, pardon me? How do you do it? Oh, okay, so, I mean, like, you can do it. It gets much more complicated, so... I'm not going to be able to sketch it out here, but there are methods for solving, for doing time-dependent perturbation theory. Yeah, but I mean, I'm just not going to cover it in this lecture because it's quite involved. So here we had time-independent perturbation theory. Here we have time-dependent potential, but not using perturbation theory, using a different method. Not perturbation theory. Okay, so what we want to do, you've probably done things like gone between the Heisenberg picture and the Schrodinger picture, and you do this by, you know, applying a transformation. And so here we go into what's known as interaction picture, which some people like to say it's, you know, somewhere in between the Heisenberg and the Schrodinger picture, because then we have time dependence on the operators as well as the states. And so the transformation that we make is, well, we define, let me write this down. So we define the state in the interaction picture, which I'm using the subscript I for. And we're going to use the known Hamiltonian to transform into this interaction picture. And because the Hamiltonian, the known Hamiltonian, is not time dependent, then you know, the transformation is nice and simple like this. And we can also define operators in the interaction picture, where now we transform from both sides. And in particular, the operator that we're going to be interested in transforming is going to be this time-dependent potential. So we will define the interaction picture. I can call this the interaction Hamiltonian as the transformed interaction Hamiltonian. Yes. This one or that one? Yes? Is that the problem? Yeah. Yeah, I'm just so used to always putting a minus sign there. It's really weird when it's not there. Okay, good, thank you. Okay, so the reason that you want to do this is because usually the, you know, the entire state is going to evolve according to this whole Hamiltonian. But if you go into the interaction picture, then your state is going to evolve only according to this component. You don't have to, you know, do the calculation using the entire Hamiltonian. So this greatly simplifies things. So now, so in interaction picture, the evolution is given by the Schrodinger equation just for the interaction picture potential. And we can also write down the time dependence for operators. In terms of a commutator of the operator and the Hamiltonian. Yeah, I think I don't have it as a scrubs in my notes, but I think it's supposed to be the interaction picture. Okay. So if we expand our state in a basis that is the eigenbasis of this known solution, in the interaction picture, we will have coefficients that are time dependent. And then you can figure out the differential equation that governs how these coefficients evolve just by plugging this into the Schrodinger equation. So we get so what I've done here is I've defined the matrix coefficients of, so this is now not in the interaction picture. This is, these are the matrix coefficients of this potential in the Schrodinger picture. And I've defined this frequency, which is given by the energy difference. Between the energies of the known of the, so between the eigenenergies and a sum over the other eigenenergies. Okay, so right, so what we have there is an expression that tells us how a state, well, how the coefficients that determine the state are going to evolve if we have a Hamiltonian that can be composed into, you know, this known Hamiltonian plus a time-dependent part. And so the problem that I wanted to, the example that I wanted to give you of a system that can be solved exactly using the interaction picture is what's known as the time-dependent two-state problem. So I'll just write down the Hamiltonian for that, and then we'll go through it in the tutorial. I think it's a good one to do yourself anyway. But let's just write it down so you can have it in your head. So we're going to have the known Hamiltonian is going to be just the energy of the two states, where we're just going to say that E2 is greater than E1. And we're going to have a harmonic potential. And so here we have the time-dependent potential, and it's just going to change, you know, as oscillate as a function of time. So in tomorrow's tutorial, we're going to go through and take this problem and use the interaction picture to find exact solutions for it. Okay, so that's pretty much all I can get through today. I just wanted to summarize the lecture again and give you some few key points that you should take away from the lecture. So we've seen that we can formulate quantum mechanics in terms of these abstract vector spaces, and we've seen how operators act on these vectors and how we can define an inner product. The states and the operators, they can be represented in a matrix representation, and so the matrix representation is basis dependent, but it gives you a nice way of visualizing what's going on. Measurement can be described in terms of the eigenstates of observables. And measurement also affects the, it interacts with the state in a way. So when you make a measurement, it's going to change, in general, it's going to change the state. If we have time dependent Hamiltonians, the solutions are still given by the Schrodinger equation, but these solutions are you know, much more ugly than the ones that we were dealing with yesterday. But there are methods that we can use to solve even, you know, the nastier types of Hamiltonians. And so one of those methods is perturbation theory, where we take a known solution and then we expand the states and the energies in terms of perturbations, we expanded in terms of the difference between the known solution and the the known Hamiltonian and the actual Hamiltonian. Let me say that again. I'm not going to say it. You guys know. I sketched out the interaction picture and how it can be used to solve other problems where we won't use perturbation theory. And I wanted to go through the two-state problem, but we'll do that in the tutorial. So are there any other questions before we wrap up? Yes?
Is it
That should be, yeah, that is, I believe it's alpha ti, yeah. Yeah, because there's a time dependence on the coefficients. Sorry, who were you asking? So yeah. Right, because the coefficients will have all the time dependence. I think you may be right. I'll just put a question mark near there. But we're not, yeah, those basis states don't have the time dependence, yeah. Hang on, let me just try and, what? Yeah, I think you're right that there is no, that's not in the interaction picture. But I'm just going to put a question mark there. Because I can't do it on the spot in my head. Yes,
Caleb. I think in the interaction picture, time evolution operator should be proportional to commutator with H naught, not the full Hamiltonian, just the. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to. Yeah. Okay, anything else? Okay, great. Well, enjoy your lunch and see you this afternoon at the tutorial. So please bring your laptops and make sure that Mathematica is running.